rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Glad to have you here with us today on this beautiful Thursday afternoon, or morning, depending on where you are. It's morning here, actually, in Portland, Oregon. June 16th is the date. Yesterday we reported that Saudi Arabia was refusing to allow UN inspectors to check out whether or not they had an active nuclear weapons program going on. Turns out today the board members of the UN Atomic Watchdog Agency approved a deal Thursday. That, of course, it was, you know, in Europe. It would have been very early Thursday morning for all of us. Hours ago, that exempts Saudi Arabia from nuclear inspections despite serious misgivings about the arrangement in an era of heightened proliferation fears. So aren't you reassured now that we don't have to worry? Saudi Arabia is not going to be inspected, so we won't learn what we don't know, and we won't have to worry about what we don't know that we don't know, because we won't know about it. So everything is fine. Everything is fine. Just ask anybody in the Bush administration, or in particular anybody in the Bush family that has received over $1 billion from Saudi Arabia and the bin Laden family for direct payments either to the Bush family or corporations affiliated with the Bush family over the past 35 years. Just ask them. No problem. The Republicans are taking their party back just a little bit, just one little sliver, step by step here. Step by step. This was a big victory in the House of Representatives. Congressman Bernie Sanders, who will be with us tomorrow in our regular Brunch with Bernie segment, Congressman Bernie Sanders, the only independent in the House of Representatives. Bernie is neither Republican nor Democrat. The only independent in the House of Representatives forged a bipartisan coalition. He had Republicans and Democrats together. Imagine that. Sign in on this thing, or sign off on this thing. Or vote for this bill that was an amendment that would have blocked the FBI and the Justice Department from using the Patriot Act to search library and bookstore records without first going to a judge and getting a warrant. What's amazing, notes David Sirota, is how many Republicans defied the White House's veto threat to side with almost every Democrat to pass this measure. It shows that if Democrats are willing to show some guts and not be intimidated by the Bush administration's bullying tactics, they can win the day. Let's hope the Democrats take heed of this and follow the House's lead in the Senate when this legislation ends up there. It's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out. Yeah, here in Vermont, or here in Oregon, rather, Greg Baird, of Washington State, he even voted for this thing. So here we had Walden and Baird. Lots of Republicans and a bunch of Democrats. So this is a significant victory for Bernie Sanders. We'll let him tell us more about it tomorrow, you know, rather than going into a whole lot of details on this thing. Turns out that once again, you know, the question, why is it that George Bush thinks the economy is so good? Why is he so out of touch with the average working person? Why is it that he has apparently no conception of what it must be like to live one day, one paycheck away or five paychecks away from disaster? You know, the average American working person is within 6 months of total financial disaster if they lose their job or if they get hit by a serious financial difficulty. And why is it that Bush seems to be completely out of touch with this? Why is it that so many Democrats even seem to be out of touch with it? I mean, Joe Biden voting for the bankruptcy bill, Debbie Stabenow voting for the bankruptcy bill. What's with these folks? And at least in the case of George W. Bush, Karl Rove saw his stock and bond fund rise last year to around $2.5 million in value. He's a multimillionaire. Andrew Card, White House Chief of Staff, he's a multimillionaire. Dan Bartlett, counselor to the president, he's a multimillionaire. Alan Hubbard, the Bush's top economic advisor, $23.6 million in private equity holdings, plus, you know, other things, $1.9 million in his retirement accounts. Yes, let's privatize Social Security, he says. Alan Hubbard, Bush's top economic advisor. Not only that, his wife Kathy has $415,000 in investments, and his kids have $3.1 million in assets. Spread it around. Yeah, Alan Hubbard, he's, hey, come on, America, you can just do like we did, yes. Stephen Hadley, the national security advisor, he's a multimillionaire. What a surprise. What a surprise. Hubbard was a classmate of Bush's at the Harvard Business School, by the way, and became president of the Indianapolis-based E&A Industries chemical conglomerate before Bush appointed him as the as his top economic advisor. That Alan Hubbard, the multimillionaire, his wife's a multimillionaire, his kids are multimillionaires, and he's the one who's saying, here's what the economic policy of the United States should be like. Here's how we should do it. And my statement to the Republicans who may be listening is, please take back your party. Please take back your party. I think it's just, it's time to take back your party. Back in Abraham Lincoln's era, the beginning of the Republican Party, Abraham Lincoln was the first Republican president. Forget what it says on WhiteHouse.gov. I realize that on WhiteHouse.gov, the White House has reinvented, on it, I am not kidding you, they have reinvented some of the early presidents of the United States. If you go look at James Madison's biography, it particularly galls me. James Madison is an ancestor of mine. And you go look at James Madison's biography on WhiteHouse.gov, and it says that he was a Republican. The Republican Party was not started until 1856 in Jackson, Michigan. And it didn't exist. I'm sorry. The party was called the Democratic Republicans, and by the time Andrew Jackson came along, they had dropped the word Republicans altogether. But James Madison, in many of his letters, simply referred to them as Democrats, particularly after he left office. He increasingly stopped using the word Republican and started using the word Democrat. And then James Monroe, who followed him, who was a member of the Democratic Republicans, which is the Democratic Party, today's Democratic Party, was founded by Thomas Jefferson, the oldest political party in the history of the world. The oldest continuously operating and still operating political party in the history of the world. I don't know why the Democrats don't talk about this more, that Thomas Jefferson founded their party. But if you go to WhiteHouse.gov, you know, the official White House website, and you click on history up at the top, and then you click on presidents, and you'll see a list of all the presidents, and then click on, you know, not alphabetical, because they got it alphabetical, so you see John Adams up there, who was, you know, one of the first, you know, he was the first one who wanted to put newspaper editors in jail, and in fact actually did it, right, with the Alien and Sedition Acts. And, you know, order them by date, and click on James Madison's biography, and James Monroe's biography, and Andrew Jackson's biography, and you'll discover that the Bushies are telling you now, these guys are Republicans. So anyhow, but what I'm saying is that the Republican Party actually started in the 1850s. It actually started as a party of reform, because by the 1850s, the Democratic Party had become the party of slavery, and it had become the party of entrenched political interests, of power. It had been corrupted by that time. You know, Thomas Jefferson wouldn't have recognized his own party. And the American people said, enough of this. We don't want this. And they elected Abraham Lincoln. And Lincoln was talk about a uniter, not a divider. You know, Andrew Johnson, the guy who became president when Lincoln was assassinated, he was Lincoln's vice president. Lincoln chose him. He was a Democrat. Lincoln chose a Democrat as his vice president, as a way of trying to heal America. Boy, do we need statesmen like that again. We so need statesmen again. But anyhow, Abraham Lincoln said, labor is prior to and independent of capital. Capital is only the fruit of labor. In other words, you can't make money until somebody makes something. Capital is only the fruit of labor and could never have existed if labor had not first existed. Labor is superior to capital and deserves the higher consideration. That, Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln saying that. And then, whoop, sorry about that. And then at the same time, we have, you know, the Walmart now, coming up with their... In fact, let's just do a full-fledged, real live, full-blown, actual Walmart alert.
I hate Walmart.
I hate Walmart.
Yes, indeed.
Historic. Well, here's how it is. Big company sell for low cost. Drive mom and pop out of business. Pretty soon all over the land. One big square store, identical brand, and that's why.
Walmart officials in Cross Lanes, North Carolina, told employees on Tuesday that they have to start working practically any shift, any day they're asked, even if they've built up years of seniority and can't arrange child care. Workers who have, this from Joe Morris in the Charleston Gazette, workers who have had regular shifts at the store for years now have to commit to being available for any shift from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. 7 days a week. If they can't make the commitment by the end of this week, they'll be fired. Several single mothers working at the store have no choice now but to quit, said one employee who would not give her name for fear of retribution. She said, my daycare closes at 6. My babysitter can't work past 5, said the employee, a mother of two who had been cashier for more than 3 years. Neither of the services available over the weekend, she said. I have to be terminated. I don't know what I'll do. Along with the open availability policy, this is what Walmart calls it, the store is requiring all floor employees to learn how to run cash registers. Several employees said they suspected this is an attempt to brace for the departure of many employees who now work as cashiers. The worker said the past year they've been really nitpicking longer-term employees who are paid more. A lot of people were mad. There were women crying. It's just terrible, said the worker, who has been at the store 6 years. I've put up with a few things, but this has to be the worst thing I've seen them do. Let's keep in mind the Walmart, $8 billion in profits last year. If their profit had been only $1 billion lower, they could have paid all of their employees all across the United States a living wage, and they could have provided them all with health care. All of them. If they made only $7 billion instead of $8 billion. But the Walton family, that's doing very well, thank you very much, sitting on their butts around the pool, waiting for the dividend checks to show up, and then only paying 15% income tax on it, and only on the first $90,000 that comes in out of those billions do they have to pay any Social Security tax whatsoever. The Walton family is like, we've just got to have that profit. Sorry, you can't do it. We've got to have it. It's all about money for the shareholders. It's all about money for the ownership class in America. As Warren Buffett said, yes, there is class warfare in America. My class has declared it, and my class is winning, said Warren Buffett, the second richest man in the United States. I want to get back to the Republican Party and why Republicans should be taking back the Republican Party, going back to the ideals of Lincoln, back to the 1872 platform of the Republican Party. Why is that relevant today? We've got Bill Frist grandstanding on the floor of the Senate about Terri Schiavo. We'll get to all that right after this. It's the Tom Hartman radio program exposing the con in conservative. 20 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
To walk within the lines would make my life so boring.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. You know, the thing that got me started on this is actually an article in today's Wall Street Journal. It's headlined, Republican strains emerge over Iraq. Some Republicans are starting to edge away from the White House on its policies in the war on terror. The strains were on display yesterday at a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing in Guantanamo Bay to address what Chairman Arlen Specter called the crazy quilt system that governs the treatment of 520 suspected enemy combatants there. Specter, of course, a Republican, a rather worried Republican. And compared to Rick Santorum, he's actually in good shape. Of course, he's not up for re-election in 2006 like Santorum is. Lindsey Graham from South Carolina says we're going to lose this war if we don't watch it. Of course, it's not a war any longer. I mean, it was a war up until May when Bush declared victory. Now it's an occupation. And they should start calling it that. Representative Walter Jones, North Carolina, saying, hey, let's fix a date. Mel Martinez, Republican from Florida, former Bush cabinet member. He goes over to Iraq. He comes back. He says, I'm discouraged. So Chuck Hagel, he's criticizing the administration. All of this in the Wall Street Journal today, pointing out that the Republican Party is starting to crack. And I'm suggesting that the Republican Party should go back to where they started. Abraham Lincoln saying, you know, very straightforward, you know, that they are the party of reform. They are the party of the people. Labor, Lincoln said, is prior to and independent of capital. Capital is only the fruit of labor and could never have existed if labor had not first existed. Labor is superior to capital and deserves the higher consideration. But that ain't half of it. The Republicans in 1872 believed that the national debt that was left over from the Civil War should be paid off as quickly as possible, and that the budget must not only be balanced, but show a surplus, while at the same time paying pensions to retired persons. The Republican Party, they were in favor of a national pension program. It's right there in their platform, 1872 Republican Party platform. They were also protectionists. They were in favor of import duties and tariffs to protect working people's salaries and to keep manufacturing jobs from moving offshore. Here's what their platform said, and I quote, from the platform of the Republican Party, 1872, the nation's annual revenue, after paying current expenditures, pensions, and the interest on the public debt, should furnish a moderate balance for the reduction of the principal of the national debt, and that revenue should be raised by duties upon importations, the details of which duties should be adjusted so as to aid in securing remunerative wages to labor and promote the industries, prosperity, and growth of the whole country. End of quote. The Republican Party platform. The Republicans in 1872, having just freed the slaves, in part at least, also spoke to that era's women's struggle for equal rights. Their platform, the Republican Party platform in 1872, said, the Republican Party is mindful of its obligations to the loyal women of America for their noble devotion to the cause of freedom. Their admission to wider fields of usefulness is viewed with satisfaction, and the honest demand of any class of citizens for additional rights should be treated with respectful consideration. The Republicans of 1872 had repeated most of Lincoln's wartime abrogations of civil rights, and opposed any other Patriot Act-like interferences with civil liberties. They were rediscovering the Bill of Rights, and so in their party platform, Plank 16 reads, the Republican Party proposes to respect the rights reserved by the people to themselves as carefully as the powers delegated by them to the states and the federal government. It disapproves of the resort to unconstitutional laws for the purpose of removing evils by interference with rights not surrendered by the people to either the state or national government. This is the Republican Party! Republicans, take back your party, please! The party platform said that Republicans would embrace, quote, only modest patriotism and incorruptible integrity in our leaders, end quote, because the nation's, quote, honor is kept in high respect throughout the world, end quote. Where have we gone? Where have the Republicans gone? Well, they've been bought out. They've been bought out. I mean, it's just the bottom line. Multinational corporations who don't give a damn about America have bought out the Republican Party lock, stock, and barrel. They own these guys. And thus you see this insane legislation, and not just the Republicans, a few Democrats along with them. And you see the insane stuff, WTO, NAFTA, CAFTA, bankruptcy bills, on and on. 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Republicans, please take back your party. Wouldn't it be nice? Wouldn't it be nice? Don't you get this? 1872, the Republican Party platform. They're looking back on Lincoln's election. They said, during 11 years of supremacy, the Republican Party has accepted with grand courage the solemn duties of the time. We have emancipated 4 million slaves, decreed the equal citizenship of all, and established universal suffrage. Exhibiting unparalleled magnanimity, the Republican Party criminally punished no man for political offenses, and tax revenues have been carefully collected and honestly applied. This glorious record of the past is the party's best pledge for the future, the Republicans of 1872 wrote, blissfully unaware of how corrupt their party would become. They added, perhaps presciently, "We believe the people will not entrust the government to any party or combination of men composed chiefly of those who have resisted every step of such beneficent progress." Yeah. So, the Republican Party cracks are emerging. Terry Schiavo, if you saw this, I don't have it here right in front of me. Here it is right here. Terry Schiavo, Bill Frist, before and after, USA Today. Nice little lawmakers speak out on Terry Schiavo. Today, Bill Frist's spokeswoman, Amy Call, says he never made a diagnosis of Terry Schiavo. Then, Bill Frist on March 23rd, and I quote,
"That footage, to me, depicted something very different than persistent vegetative state."
Bill Frist. Tom DeLay. Dan Allen, his spokesman, today, he says, Congressman DeLay's thoughts and prayers remain with the friends and family of Terry Schiavo. But back on March 18th, Tom DeLay,
"She's as alive as you or I. And as such, we have a moral obligation to protect and defend her."
Senator Mel Martinez, Republican from Florida, now he's saying, "I've had second thoughts as to whether a federal review was the right way to go or not." But back then, March 16, in column for National Review, he says, "She may even be able to learn to eat." Yeah, we now know that if you had put food or water in Terry Schiavo's mouth, she would have died. Because the part of her brain that controls swallowing was dead, as was the part of her brain that controls vision, as was the part of her brain that controls thinking. What was left was half a brain, also known as a brainstem. Oh, but the cons will say, this raises questions. This raises questions. Come on, come on. Anyhow, by the way, our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. The website, TomHartmann.com. However you spell it, will get you there. You can drop into our live chat. You can participate in our message board, or you can read my blog, which is basically it's called Articles on Democracy on that thing. Greg Palast has put together a list timeline on the Downing Street memo. I want to get to that in a minute. I think it's interesting that most of the nation's major newspapers are still conspicuously silent, and the few that are writing about the Downing Street memos. The hearings, by the way, will begin in about an hour and a half and will be carried live on C-SPAN Channel 3, which almost nobody gets on their cable system, but you can watch live on the web, and will be replayed tomorrow on C-SPAN Channel 2, which some people get on their cable systems, and that will be at 5 p.m. Pacific Time, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, as of this moment. Tomorrow it'll be replayed. And we're going to be recording it this afternoon here in Portland, and hopefully we'll have some clips for you tomorrow on the program. But this should be interesting. And I want to share this timeline with you. We'll get into the Downing Street memo stuff in just a minute. But first, 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. John in New York City on the line. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing today?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, John?
All right, I drive a cement truck for a living. You guys were talking about Walmart before.
Yeah.
And you were talking about how they don't have benefits for their employees. I just had another cement company, which is unionized, pass by on the block, and he asked me, "Are you guys get benefits?" I kind of felt like shit. Some of us in the company do get benefits, and some of us don't. And it's like the older people that are in the hospital are the ones that don't have the benefits. And if you don't ask for them, you're not going to get them. You really have to ask for this specific company. I'm not going to give you the name, but it probably happens all over like this.
Yeah, and the reality is that you should, as you said, you should get the benefits. And the point is that organized labor is not about, you know, having unions versus capitalism or anything like that, or, you know, however the cons want to spin it. It's really about power. It's about democracy in the workplace. It's about having some relatively equal say in the workplace. Today there was an article in the paper about how the UAW is talking about going on strike against General Motors because General Motors is trying to cut back on the benefits of particularly pensioners, people who have already retired, who were promised benefits years ago in their contracts. And the UAW is saying, no, we're not going to let you do that. There has to be a way for labor to say, hey, wait a minute, stop. We're not playing the game fair here. This isn't working for all of us. It's not working for society. It's not about greed. It's about having a middle class. And in order for that to work, two things are necessary. The first is that you have an industrial policy, a trade policy, which we've completely given up on here in the United States since Reaganomics came in. And it's not just the Republicans. Clinton signed WTO and NAFTA and you know, brought us the little shop of horrors associated with that. But fast track authority was first, you know, pushed forward by Reagan and then picked up by Bush Sr., where the president could negotiate these side trade deals with individual countries and just blow away tariffs. But we have to have an industrial policy, number one. And number two, we have to have labor policy that gives labor unions that those kinds of abilities. It gives them the ability to respond, that gives them the ability to participate in the workplace. And that means things like card checks. So if you want to join a union, it's a simple matter. You check out, you vote. You get to vote. It's a democracy. And if democracy is so good that we should be dying and bleeding in Iraq to promote democracy, then why not have democracy in the workplace?
You're absolutely right.
It's, you know, it's just a very simple, very bottom line thing. John, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894. Keith in New Mexico on the line. Hey, Keith, what's up?
Oh, yes, sir. I have a number of comments, actually. One, we're not in Iraq because of any sort of problems that we're in Iraq. We're in Iraq because there's a family grudge between the Bushes and Saddam Hussein.
I think that that's probably a piece of it. I think that, in fact, if you want to try and psychoanalyze it, I suspect that there's even a larger piece of it is that Junior wanted to show up Senior, that George W. Bush...
He wanted to finish what Senior didn't finish.
That's right, because and well, it's not even that. It's the these two men have ever since George W. Bush's adolescence, when I mean, basically he was kicked out of the house. He was sent off to Andover. He didn't much interact with his father at all throughout his life. And on the few occasions when he did, very often, I mean, he tried to beat his father up once. And you know, this is not, you know, liberal, you know, I mean, he talks in his autobiography about how, you know, when he was drinking, he tried to take his father. He said, mano a mano, come on, let's have a fist fight. One night when he came home, driving home drunk and hit a trash can out in front of the house. And, you know, I think that there's a... He so intensely dislikes his father. It's one of the reasons why if you call him Junior in his presence, he actually turns red. That part of it was he wanted to prove that he was more of a man than his father was, that he was tougher. But I really don't think that that's the prime motivation. I think those were all bennies.
That's a benny. That's part of it. I also think that 9/11 wouldn't have happened if we had not had a Bush in the White House.
Well, absolutely right. In fact, when I talked with Sandy Berger, this was at a meeting two years ago, he met with some of us in the press, and he said that when Clinton handed off to Bush, when Gore handed off to Cheney, and when he handed off to Condi Rice, all three of them said, your number one priority is going to be Osama bin Laden. This guy is determined to get us. He's already hit us several times. You know, he blew up an embassy. He took out a ship. He's, you know, the Cole, USS Cole. We have tried to kill him several times. We missed him by 30 minutes with a missile attack in Saudi Arabia. He's got this training nest going on there. We're trying to get it out. We're going to have to work with Afghanistan. We got to take this guy out. He's going to be your number one priority. Plus, he's trying to infiltrate terrorists into the United States. You need to be looking for that. And so in response to that, Bush said, okay, Cheney, you're in charge of the counterterrorism task force. Do something about it. And Cheney, that counterterrorism task force never met before 9/11, before September of 2001.
Right.
Never even met. Cheney was too busy cutting deals with oil companies. And
I remember that day specifically. I was working in the call center in Dallas-Fort Worth. And when it happened, we were getting information from callers and figuring out what was going on.
Yeah.
And I stood up and said, it's Osama bin Laden.
Yeah.
And, of course, nobody around me knew who I was talking about, and most of the people around me didn't know who, what the World Trade Center was.
Yeah, well, Bush had, you know, we learned during the 9/11 hearings about the famous August 6th presidential daily briefing headlined Osama bin Laden determined to strike inside the United States. But now we've learned, after the election, after the declassified material came out after the election, we learned that there were over 50 of these briefing papers, that on one occasion when Bush was over in Europe for a G8 meeting, there were the Osama bin Laden, the intelligence was that Osama bin Laden's guys were going to hijack a commercial airliner and fly it into the hotel he was staying in, and so they moved him out to a U.S. destroyer ship out in the Mediterranean so that he could be protected from that. And then after 9/11, and this was, you know, 3 months before 9/11. And so then after 9/11, Condi Rice, his national security advisor, who was there and knew about that, says, oh, we never could have, she's on Tim Russert, I think it was, she says, nobody could have imagined that somebody would hijack an airplane and use it as a missile. I mean, if we had just, you know, we couldn't even have imagined it. Come on, they'd already moved George to avoid that threat.
Yeah.
Over 50 specific warnings.
How far-fetched is that?
It's incredibly far-fetched. I mean, this is the biggest security failure in the history of the United States, and it happened on the watch of George W. Bush, Condi Rice, Dick Cheney, and Don Rumsfeld, and none of them have been held accountable for it. And what infuriates me the most is that the Democrats haven't held them accountable for it.
Exactly.
So.
And right now, the state of the economy, on a different note,
yeah,
with respect still to George Bush,
we are net 24,000 jobs below where we were the day that George Bush took office.
But his
he has not yet created one positive job. But the rich are getting richer, and the middle class is getting poorer.
His friends are benefiting.
His friends are doing just great. Thank you very much. They are getting very, very wealthy. And people who are making 60, 70, 80, 90, 100, 150, 100, even $200,000 a year, they think, well, you know, we should be Republicans, they're saying, because they think that that's the bunch that Bush is looking out for. Sorry, people who are making $10 million a year are paying lower income taxes than people who are making $150,000 a year. It is
most of us would pray to make $50,000 a year.
Yeah, I know. But see, the thing is, I mean, there, even the quote white collar middle class or the upper middle class, Bush has got them bamboozled. He's got the guys making $20,000 a year driving pickup trucks. He's got them bamboozled. He's got them terrified the gays are coming to get them. He's got the people making $100,000 a year convinced that Bush is going to help them out with tax cuts, that's borrowing money from their children and wiping out the ability of their own kids to go to college, you know, which is how most of them got to be able to make that kind of money. And the only folks that Bush is looking out for are the millionaires and billionaires. And I'm serious,
and
millionaires and billionaires.
And we're struggling to make $20,000 a year. We're never going to be able to retire because they keep pushing Social Security back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I'm 48. I'm 48, and you know it's scary.
Yeah, and Keith, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. And you are reflecting, and thanks for listening to us there in KRSN in New Mexico. And that you are reflecting a feeling that is so pervasive across the United States. So pervasive. People are actually, you know, terrified, and justifiably so. In the next hour of the program, I want to get into another story in the Wall Street Journal today about the housing bubble ain't just in the United States, and when it goes down, it's going to be bigger than anybody ever imagined. Kate in Humboldt County on the line. Hey, Kate, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to get back to Iraq for a minute.
Yes.
You were saying that it stopped being a war when Bush, you know, declared it over, and now it's an occupation.
Right.
But I think it would be more accurate not even to call it a war. I think it was an invasion.
Sure, of course.
And I think that's a better word to use. It reflects reality better. And those of us on the left or the right don't like to think of our country in those terms. But I think we need to start realizing that that's what we did, and the only way to do that is calling it invasion.
You're absolutely right, Kate. And if I use the word war again, you know, call me up and let me know.
Great.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
I appreciate it. You know, it's the Kate, the language police on the one hand. On the other hand, no, she's right. She's right. Words do count. John in Eastern Connecticut on the line. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Great show. Pleasure being on.
Thank you.
I think, I think what you're doing and talk radio is amazing. And, I think, we have an amazing system. If we can just get the information out there, I think, I have faith that, folks will make the right decision. I want to say that a couple of things. I think the high watermark of the Bush administration, I just got a really warm feeling when McCain finally enough's enough struck the compromise, and I think dominoes are going to start to fall here. They already are.
I mean, that was the gist of this article in the Wall Street Journal today, is that the cracks are showing in the Republican Party.
Yeah, and amen. I think, you know, I want to be humble and willing to learn. I think that's the key bottom line. And I feel like a little bit off the subject, but I feel like your show is awesome, and it points out a lot of the what's wrong. And but on your in your book, you touched upon something that's extremely important, which is an awareness, a group consciousness, however you would couch it, that we will kind of wake up and realize that we need to work together here.
Which book was that?
Which of my books? The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. There's evidence of that in critical mass. Some people say that critical mass, you know, started, I believe, in San Francisco with the bike riders taking to the streets. It's worldwide now.
Yeah.
At 7 o'clock on last Friday, there's no agenda, no leader, no nothing. I think.
Yeah, it's about consciousness ultimately. I agree with you, John, and thank you for the kind words about my book. But you're absolutely right. We have to wake ourselves up, and then we have to wake others up, and it does spread. It doesn't require a leader. It's a movement. It's the Tom Hartman program, too. 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
He took all the trees and put them in a tree museum. And he charged the people a dollar and a half to see them.
And welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. 1-866-889-8894. Jay in Chicago on the line. Hey, Jay, welcome to the program.
Hey, I was wondering, hypothetically, if you could go back in time to meet Jefferson and tell him and the rest of the guys about how the election was stolen in 2000 and the shenanigans in Ohio. Do you think you and them could write anything into the Constitution that would have prevented that from happening in the first place?
Well, it's already illegal what they did. The only way that they're preventing going to prison is the fact that they control the House, the Senate, the executive branch, that Bush put his lawyer in charge of the Justice Department, which controls the FBI. I mean, they've basically seized control of the entire apparatus of governance in the United States, not unlike the way that Mussolini took over control of everything in Italy, and then, you know, a few years later, Hitler did the same thing in Germany. I mean, once you have control, and not to mention Stalin in the Soviet Union, once you have control of all of the various dimensions of a multidimensional government, the checks and balances are gone. And this is what they've even got to control the judiciary. This would have Thomas Jefferson pulling his hair out, I'll tell you.
Well, what if they had written into the Constitution a rule about, you know, only using paper ballots or something like that, and then whatever it would take to avoid the possibility of those kind of shenanigans?
But see, there was massive vote fraud happening in the United States, you know, a century ago with paper ballots. That's where the phrase "stuffing the ballot box" comes from. So paper ballots are not the solution. They're part of a solution for now, but the bigger solution is that you have to have a system that is really multidimensional, that has oversight by both bipartisans, that is to say, you know, Republicans and Democrats and Greens and anybody else can watch the count being counted, that has some sort of verifiable paper trail, that is immune to hacking and manipulation. I mean, it's a multidimensional thing. But frankly, any kind of tampering with the vote is a crime, and it's always been a crime. Although at the federal level, it's not a crime, because the federal constitution said that each state can figure out how to handle their own vote. They figured this is something that the state should handle. This is part of the problem. States get to decide, you know, whether or not they're going to have voting machines and things like this, and that makes it a little harder at the national level. Although it's not impossible. I mean, the Help America Vote Act certainly set the precedent for that. So,
like, it's 2006, we're in trouble again.
Well, unless the Democrats will get out there and get some exit polls going, or unless we can develop a sufficiently overwhelming majority of people to show up at the polls and say, "Hey, wait a minute, I want my country back. I'm going to vote Democratic, or I'm going to vote for anybody but the Republican, and take back at least the Senate, and ideally the Senate and the House in 2006." And I don't think it's impossible. I think it's entirely possible. I think people are fed up. Jay, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. I do appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Our website, TomHartman.com. You can click live chat if you want to drop into one of the most fascinating, interesting, entertaining, lively, fast-moving, factual, informational live chat rooms. No, real people in real time. They actually interact with each other and the entire internet. And occasionally it gets a little weird. Just go to TomHartman.com and click live chat. Or if you want to call a program, which is equally fascinating, entertaining, live, fast-paced, you can talk to a real person. That's me right here. A live radio. Oh, the wonders of it. Our telephone number, 866-889-8894. And as promised, in a few minutes, we are going to get into this timeline of the memos. This, because I think people just don't get it, you know, what's going on with this. And how Rumsfeld is working so hard, I mean so hard, to obscure the reality of what's going on, and particularly in Guantanamo Bay, where we've built now five concentration camps. We're building a sixth one, and the BBC reported 2 weeks ago, big news in Europe. I mean, big news. Major BBC headline was not reported at all in the United States, that the United States has developed plans to build a death chamber. A death chamber for carrying out the executions of those people in Guantanamo Bay who are sentenced to death for crimes they may have committed on the battlefield in Afghanistan. So we are adding a death chamber to our concentration camps. And it's giving us a bit of a black eye around the world. And a lot of Republicans now, are starting to say, hey, wait a minute. Hey, wait a minute. This is not working. I'm sorry. But George W. Bush, you are putting a bullseye on the back of American tourists, American business people, and American soldiers all over the world. It ain't good what you're doing. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Gene in Cleveland, listening to us on Radio Free Ohio, AM 1320 WARF. Hey, Gene, what's up? Whoop, hey.
Who you got?
I'm sorry, Gene. I didn't have you potted up there. Start again.
Yeah, great show you have. I really like you.
Well, thank you.
I have questions for Democrats. When we tell the truth, okay, it seems like the truth offends Republicans. And when Howard Dean speaks, they all go running to him, and then they find Democrats that agree with him when he's just telling the truth. Why don't Democrats, when they get questions about the religious right, you know, on this and that, why don't we just ask them, well, what about the Downing Street memos? Come back with questions instead of, you know, just cowering in a corner because they're asking them questions. We're losing it. We really are losing it.
I don't disagree.
You know,
I was
a union steward, and negotiation is very important. When both sides leave and you give a little bit on both sides and both sides felt that they gave up a little bit, that is an agreement.
That's a negotiation.
We don't have that anymore.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree. In fact, we're starting to look for opportunities to catch Howard Dean doing things right and congratulate him on things.
Right.
I absolutely agree. In fact, Louise just put this together yesterday, and it's so cool. This is the theme music for our Howard Dean alerts. Here it is. Whoops. Hang on just a second. Let me start it up.
Taking my country back.
We're going to California and Texas and New York. And we're going to South Dakota and Oregon and Washington and Michigan. And then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House.
Yeah! So I'm taking my country back.
See, and I want to make the Dean scream into something positive. He is our cheerleader.
Nobody was booing him when he said that.
No, they were cheering him.
Everybody was cheering.
That's
right.
So
when Dean is saying all these things, everybody is cheering because we are actually telling the truth.
Yeah.
We got to tell the truth about George Bush. He's the worst commander-in-chief we've ever had in this country.
Yes.
A large country like Iraq that has 25 million people, we have the most powerful military the world has ever seen, and he can't go in there and control a country. Aren't people saying, hey George Bush, where is the leader.
Well, and not only that, I mean, we've halfway bombed them back to the Stone Age, and certainly in Afghanistan we bombed them back to the Stone Age, and now we don't even control all of the city of Kabul. I mean, you know, Hamid Karzai, the former Unocal oil company executive who was trying to negotiate a gas pipeline across Afghanistan on behalf of Unocal for years and years and years, an old friend of the Bushies and of Halliburton and whatnot, was unsuccessful in his negotiations. Now he's the so-called president of Afghanistan, and now we have three military bases right along the route where we just happen to be building that gas pipeline. And those three military bases, that gas pipeline, and a good chunk of Kabul are the only things that we control anymore. Afghanistan has become the largest narco state in the world. They are producing so much. Last year they produced more opium than any country ever in the history of the planet. Even back when the British were forcing the Chinese to buy opium 100 years ago, and the Chinese fought an opium war over it, saying, no, we don't want any more. Enough. Thank you already. And they lost Hong Kong over it. Afghanistan last year produced even more than then. And it is the major crop that's coming out of there. We have no control. The warlords are back. The Taliban is back. The women are back in their burqas. You can't go out safely anywhere in the country. We are losing. An American soldier serving in Afghanistan right now has a higher probability of dying than a soldier serving in Iraq. And nobody's talking about Afghanistan. And you know, we can't control Iraq. We can't even control Afghanistan. And that's a third the size of Iraq.
Well, that's part of the Bush policy. They were trying to build the perfect red states by not having any weapons control, high unemployment, outsourcing all the industry, like in Iraq. They gave all the oil industry to Halliburton. They outsourced it. And people do not like outsourcing.
Yeah.
People do not like having their jobs given away to foreigners like we are doing in this country. We're getting everything outsourced, and now he wants another trade agreement with Central America, and we're just going to outsource more jobs. Democrats, we have to wake up.
Yeah.
We have to start fighting, and we have to start putting our shoes in some of these Republicans' rear ends.
Well said, Gene. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Very well said. We really do. And it is time for Democrats to get a spine and stand up to the Republicans. And Howard Dean is trying to teach them how to do that. And then you get Joe Biden, who voted for the bankruptcy bill, going, well, he doesn't speak for me. I used to have a lot of respect for Joe Biden. You know, about, I don't know how long ago it was, maybe a year ago, I was at a conference in Washington, D.C., and had an opportunity to sit in the same room with Joe Biden and hear him talk about foreign policy. And I was really impressed. The guy is really smart. But he voted for the bankruptcy bill. And now he's saying, well, Howard Dean, he doesn't speak for me. Come on. Call Joe Biden and tell him what you think of him. 1-877-SOB-USOB is the toll-free number of Congress. No, it's not a joke. I'm not making it up. It's the old Senate office building toll-free number. And so it's a Senate office building, United States Senate office building. 1-877-SOB-USOB is the toll-free number of Congress. And you can ask for your member of Congress. You can ask for one of your senators. You can ask for your member of Congress. And just, you know, pick an issue. Pick an issue. You know, let's start a draft or get out of Iraq. You know, for example. Or if it's a Democrat that you're talking to, hey, I support Howard Dean. Would you please also? Or if it's a Republican you're talking to, hey, why don't you guys take your party back from these so-called conservatives, these neocons, these wackos who are hell-bent for leather on destroying the Republican Party with insane economic policies, with what George Herbert Walker Bush, George Bush Sr., correctly called voodoo economics. You know, Well, you get the idea. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number. 1-866, toll-free across the United States, 866-889-8894. Tomas in Grand Rapids, listening on WTKG in Grand Rapids. Hey, Tomas.
How you doing, Tom? You know, Thursday is a good day to go to the gym and get some martial arts in because then your bruises heal up Friday and you can enjoy the weekend. So, you know, I'm usually coughing, but let's go.
So you're gonna call me up and kick me upside the head here, Tomas?
Nah, but put your little, your combat stuff on and we'll go to the dojo of intellectual warfare.
Okay, all right.
We'll get a little rough this time, but. You know, I'm going to say something that'll start you off. I believe that if the liberals had defended the United States after the first World Trade Center attack in 1993, as conservatives had defended us after 2001, we wouldn't have had 2001.
Okay, tell me what that defense would have looked like.
It would have looked like attacking some of the states that are sponsors of terrorism, some of the countries were on the State Department list.
Okay, so let's just take this step by step, Tomas, because I think you make a really good point. First of all, after the World Trade Center attack, we identified the people responsible for it. We tracked them down as criminals. We prosecuted them. And Abdel Rahman, the guy who organized the thing, is in prison right now in the United States. I'm assuming that you know that.
Right. And my point
I'm assuming
is
that you know that the guys responsible for the first World Trade Center bombing in the United States were tracked down by the Clinton administration, were prosecuted, and are serving life sentences in prison. I'm assuming that you know that.
Okay.
So
what I have to say.
So then you say, now your second point was that we should go after the states that sponsored them. Now, these guys were all Saudis. Are you suggesting we should have attacked Saudi Arabia?
No, well, I'm talking about the first World Trade Center.
That's what
attack.
I'm talking about. I'm talking about the 1993 attack on the World Trade Center.
Right.
Abdul Rahman was a Saudi. The guys who did it were Saudis, most of them. So you're suggesting that we should have attacked Saudi Arabia, right?
Okay, I have different information that that most of them were Iraqis and Egyptians. They
no, I'm sorry. You're wrong.
Well, one of the guys, the guy that mixed the chemicals, we never got him. He escaped to Baghdad and was on Baghdad TV, talking about how great the attack was. I mean, but you know, if we've got
so if one guy, let's say that that's true. I don't know if that's true or not. But let's say that that's true. Let's say we'll give you that. So if one guy commits a crime against the United States and he escapes to, let's say, France or England or Pakistan or Iraq, then we should take the entire military force of the United States, we should bomb that country, we should kill 100,000 civilians, we should allow 1,600 Americans to die to get that guy? Is that what you're saying to me, Tomas? What you mean?
Well, you asked me a question, you got to let me, I mean, you know, you got to
go for it.
Now.
Yeah, you got. I'm sorry, we're down to 35 seconds, but I'll give it all to you.
All right, well, I'm going to with my right because, you know, I'm a right winger here. Boom. But the Clinton and the Bush administration had countries that were sponsoring terrorism. And it seems to me it would have been very logical, all right, to react if the people involved in that bombing had come from and were calling, you know, one of those countries that were always on the gold medal list for terrorism, as opposed to if they had come from, like, you know, France or, you know, Iceland.
You do know that Bill Clinton threw cruise missiles into Afghanistan.
I do.
You do. Okay. So I guess I just don't understand your complaint. But, you know, there you go. Maybe I'm a dumb liberal. Tomas, thanks call. I appreciate it.
All right.
It's always good to hear from you. Give us a call more often. I love to hear from conservatives. I really and truly do. In fact, we ought to have a conservative-only day here. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. We'll be right back.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And when you're dead, you're done. So let the good time roll.
Yes. Welcome back, my friends. Time to let the good times roll. Well, it was for Mary Carey, the good times were rolling, I guess. She was having a good time. Did you see her being interviewed by Keith Olbermann last night on MSNBC? She's saying that she had several Republicans come up to her during the Republican fundraiser with George W. Bush and ask her if she wanted to participate in shall we say, activities for money with wives and girlfriends and strange places and all sorts of things. And just, you know, kind of general oddities. So, good times for Mary Carey. I want to get back to this timeline in just a moment. But first, Jason in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening. He wanted to respond to Tomas. So you guys from the same city, so I'll let you go at it. Hey, Jason.
Hey, oh, my God. These conservatives here in this town are so absolutely brainwashed. I mean, there's no word to describe what's going on.
Well, I think Tomas is a thinking guy. You know, I get it that the guy's got an intellect. I'm not sure where he's getting his information from.
Right. Well, yeah. And you know, it's okay to be intellectual and all that, but, I mean, it doesn't help to be misguided.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's kind of funny to have conversations with people like that because, you know, you point out facts. And sometimes when you point out something that they haven't heard or don't know, you know, they get this glazed over look.
Yeah.
And automatically they rebut it and say, that's not true.
Yeah.
That's not true. And I, you know, invite them. You know, as soon as you check it out, then come back and then we'll talk some more. But, you know, you need to update your information.
Yeah.
But as soon as you do that, you come back to me and then we can talk some
Clinton
more.
Was obsessed with bin Laden. And what happened was when Bush came in, all the obsession with bin Laden just went away. I mean, that's what came out of the 9/11 Commission hearings. That's, you know, Richard Clark's testimony and others. And it wasn't, you know, just from people who you might say are administration critics. I mean, the people within the administration were saying, we really weren't paying much attention to bin Laden. We were paying attention to other things like, you know, where the oil fields are in Iraq. It's, you know, the documents that the conservative Judicial Watch organization, judicialwatch.org, sued the Bush administration to see copies of.
Right. So, now, just to kind of swerve directions here real quick,
yes,
you had a gentleman on the other day, and he was talking about ecological issues. And I heard something, and I was, you know, just kind of waiting, but I didn't get a chance to call. But there was a study that said that the Earth is losing its ability to cleanse itself, you know, like... I guess, take care of the pollution that it takes in and to get rid of it.
Yes.
You know, in the way that,
yeah, I saw that.
It normally
That's...
did.
Yeah.
Do you have any more information on that, or what is the... He gave a website to
check
into.
His, that was Kenny Ossibel. He was with Bioneers, and it's bioneers.org, like pioneers only with a B.
Okay.
But the article, that the study that you're talking about, the report on it that I read on commondreams.org, and it was one of their headlines. So I'm assuming it's archived over there at commondreams.org.
Okay.
But it was from one of the science publications. And it was, yes, it was the natural, what's called bioremediation, the ability of organic systems, like the planet, or in a macro sense, you know, like local ponds and things, but whatever, the ability of biological systems to process and recover from the waste that we're dumping into them, as our waste levels have dramatically increased over the years and become more toxic and more sophisticated, more complex. We're putting in more complex molecules and molecules that are farther and farther from natural substances. The ability of the Earth to recover from these things has gone into a net negative. And historically, it's argued that it was in a net positive, at least up through the 1950s, 1960s. But it's clearly, and clearly with regard to carbon dioxide, I mean, it's obviously a net negative. That is to say, we're accumulating it as a result of human activity, and it's changing our biosphere.
And this is one thing that conservatives don't want to talk about because, you know, they really don't want to talk about why there are such large dead zones for fish populations.
Yeah, 8,000 miles off the coast of in the Gulf, you know, off the edge of the Mississippi River, a dead zone, 8,000 square miles. Conservatives, true conservatives, Barry Goldwater conservatives, Dwight Eisenhower conservatives, Teddy Roosevelt conservatives, they love to talk about this. These guys, these Republicans, and these so-called conservatives, they don't like to talk about it because really they just want to talk about profits for big multinational corporations and polluters, you know, being able to just take a pass. Thanks a lot for the call, Jason. Good to hear from you. I do appreciate it. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Bring them on.
To all the troops I sent to war, who won't be coming home no more, I'm glad you came along. I dedicate this song to all the troops I sent.
Tragic story.
All the troops remaining survive. The bees that trap you in the hive. They don't appreciate the ones who liberate. They think their land is occupied.
And welcome. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 26 minutes before the hour. And I had an interview this morning with Cindy Sheehan, Gold Star Mothers, Gold Star Families for Peace. And assuming that I can make this box work here, I just want to share this with you. This was just a remarkable insight to me. It was almost shocking, some of the things that I heard in talking with Cindy. Let me just share this with you, if we can get it to play here. And maybe it won't. No, apparently it's not going to. Huh. Okay, it ain't working. Anyhow, well, we'll come back to that. I thought we could make it work. I want to come back to this timeline on 9/11. This also a rather remarkable event. The only 1 month after the first Bush-Cheney inauguration, the State Department's Pam Quanprud organizes a secret confab in California. Right, a secret event in California to make plans for the invasion of Iraq and removal of Saddam. This is right after the inauguration. U.S. oil industry advisor Fuad Al-Jaburi and others are asked to interview would-be replacements for a new U.S.-installed dictator. A new U.S.-installed dictator, somebody who could replace Saddam. You get this? We were looking for a Saddam replacement. Is that possible? I mean, you know, could it be? And well, you know, yes. It turns out the answer is yes. And on BBC Television's Newsnight, Al-Jaburi himself says it was an invasion. It was a coup. I mean, here's Al-Jaburi himself talking about this, and he said it is an invasion, but it will act like a coup. The original plan was to liberate Iraq from the Saddamists and from the regime. Really, rather startling. I've got this clip up now. I've figured out how to make this thing work. I want to share this with you. I do a morning show on AM 620 KPOJ, Portland, Oregon, a clear channel station here in Portland, Oregon, a 25,000 watt station that serves the Pacific Northwest, and then I do this national show. And so this, if I make reference to AM 620 or whatever, that's why. This was recorded about 3 hours ago on our morning show. Now here's Cindy Sheehan of Gold Star Mothers for Peace.
You had some powerful comments for President Bush. George Bush loves to say, and in fact he most recently said in his when he and Tony Blair were doing their joint press conference and the issue of the Downing Street memos came up, he repeated his stump line where he looks like he's getting all misty and emotional and says one of the hardest jobs he has to do is to comfort the families of those who have loved who have lost loved ones in Iraq. And first of all, I'm not sure that there's any evidence that that's ever happened, although I'm assuming that he's at least met with one family, probably supporters. I'm wondering two things. Number one, has he ever met with you or anybody that you know about this? And number two, what's your take on what the hard work is with regard to the loss of families in Iraq? And talk about your own personal experience with that.
Actually, I did have the misfortune of meeting with him. My family met with him in June up at Fort Lewis, Washington. And let me tell you, that man has no comfort in him. And we left the meeting feeling far worse than we did when we walked in. You know, number one, he acted like it was a tea party. Number two, he didn't even know Casey's name, and he wouldn't look at the pictures that we brought of Casey.
Casey is your son who died in Iraq.
Who was killed in Iraq. And he didn't know our names, you know, because they made us take our name tags off before he came in. I guess for the photographer, the White House photographer, but, you know, I think it might be because he might embarrass himself by trying to read the names or something. I don't know, but, you know, it was a horrible meeting, and we didn't feel any comfort from him. And, you know, for him to say it's hard work to comfort us, how does he feel? Think it feels to, you know, have the visit from the Army coming in to tell you that your son's been killed in an illegal and immoral war. It was just real, you know. And you, if you read that article, you read what I think is hard work.
Yeah, and I did, but many of our listeners didn't. So if you could repeat that to the extent that you can,
well, you know,
I would appreciate it.
Right, you know, hard work is sending your son off to go to a war that you all know is illegal and immoral, but he goes anyway. You know, hard work is spending the 2 weeks while he was there before he was killed just worried sick, you know, not being able to sleep, not being able to eat, not being able to concentrate or focus on anything because you are so worried about your child that's in harm's way. You know, then they come over and tell you that your son is dead and you collapse on the floor and screaming, you know, and hard work is burying your son and just not wanting to jump in with him and have the earth carry you, you know, cover you both. And then that's not even the hard part. The hard part is living every day without your child that was killed so needlessly and senselessly, and then knowing the lies and just knowing that the only thing we are compelled to do is try to prevent other people from going through the same tragedy we are. You know, George Bush doesn't know the meaning of the word hard work.
He had, well, that's a whole other discussion, his having, you know, been born with a trust fund and
right.
never really had a job. But he is quite outspoken of the hard work of comforting families, and you were one of the families he comforted, and he didn't
comfort us.
He didn't say, you know, kind things or try to give you a hug or any. I mean, I don't get it.
He gave me a hug. Gave me a hug, but it was like getting a hug from, you know, a statue. I should have hugged a mannequin in the department store. He has no human. He has no human feeling. How can somebody that doesn't have any human feeling give another human being comfort? You know, it's not possible. Tom, it's just like you look in his eyes and it's blank. He has these crocodile tears. You know, his eyes do get a little misty when he's talking to you. And you know what? One thing he said to me, he goes, Mom, because he called me Mom throughout the whole interview, and I thought that was so disrespectful.
Mm.
He goes, Mom, I can't imagine losing a loved one, whether it be a son or a daughter or a brother or a sister. And he was going on and on and on about any relative that I could have, you know, had killed in the war. And I just stopped him and I said, you know, Mr. President, you know, I stopped him before he got to, maybe it was my third cousin or something like that, you know. I said, Mr. President, that's when I still called him Mr. President. It was my son. My son was killed in Iraq. And I think you can imagine, because you have two daughters, try to imagine if one of them was killed in war. And he looked at me, and he almost got a little flicker of humanness in his eyes. And I said, trust me, Mr. President, you don't want to go there. And you know what he told me? You're right, I don't.
Hmm.
And I said, well, thank you for putting me there.
Wow.
And I asked him, why did my son die? And he goes, because I believe everybody's born to be free.
His messianic, well,
right,
yeah.
So somehow Casey's death, you know, I still don't understand who Casey made free by dying in Iraq.
Yeah, this is tragic. Well, today you're going to be speaking before John Conyers' hearings.
Right.
And about these issues, what specifically will you be testifying about before John Conyers' commission this morning, or this afternoon?
Of course, I think I'm the one who's there to put a personal face on what living with these lies and betrayals that led our country into Iraq has cost some of the families in this country and in Iraq and in the world. And also, I'm going to be urging Congress, doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican, you took an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States, and it's your constitutional duty. And not only your constitutional duty, but as members of humanity, to investigate the Downing Street memo and the lies and the betrayals that led us to invade a country that was no threat to the United States of America. I'm going to be holding up a baby picture of my son Casey, you know, and I'm just going to say this is the face of tens of thousands of people who have been killed by the betrayals. And it's up to you. Nobody asked Casey if he was a Democrat or a Republican before he was sent to die in Iraq. And I'm sure that people in Iraq who have been killed have the barest understanding of American partisan politics. Somebody needs to be held accountable, and finally, Congress needs to do what's right, because they gave up their constitutional responsibility to declare war, and they let George Bush make, you know, the mistake of the century, and it's time for them to correct that and make the wrong right.
And yet the Republicans are refusing to even acknowledge these hearings. They will refuse to attend them, just like they did with John Conyers' hearings in Ohio.
Right.
Up until yesterday, they were refusing to even allow them to use a room in the Capitol building, even though they, you know, John Warner gave a room to Reverend Moon to be crowned the new Messiah. They, you know, this is too hot. And
well, I actually think, I don't think the Republicans gave us that room. I think it's a room that Mr. Conyers had available to him. And so he decided to use it, even though it's, like, really small and can barely fit the witnesses and the Congress people. So Mr. Conyers decided to use that, and everybody else who wants to watch the hearings has to go to the DNC headquarters to watch them by a live feed.
Cindy, have you noticed a turnaround in the people that you've spoken with and some of the other families who've lost their sons and daughters in the war? Have you noticed that the people are coming around to the fact that we should never have gone in the first place?
Oh, definitely. You know, even some people in my own organization, Gold Star Families for Peace, you know, they were for advocating for peace but not immediate withdrawal because they thought it would harm the people of Iraq. But now, you know, everybody just knows that it's the most important thing to do would to be get out of there to stop the killing. And I just see a groundswell. You know, I go all over the country. I've been away from my home this time since June 1st in about 6 or 7 or 8 different states already. And the groundswell of grassroots support for ending the war and holding somebody accountable has just been amazing to me. I started this journey about a year ago, and I'm noticing a very just like I said, a groundswell of support, and it is giving me hope that that eventually maybe peace, and not just peace for this war, but, you know, stopping the war machine from devouring any more of our children will be accomplished.
That was Cindy Sheehan, the founder of Gold Star Families for Peace. Their website, GSFP, as in Gold Star Families for Peace. GSFP.org. I'm Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Rick in Michigan on the line. Hey, Rick, what's on your mind today?
Well, thank you for playing that, even though that was emotionally wrenching to hear it. I wanted to commend you on the demolishing of the conservative from Grand Rapids. I actually know that guy personally, so I think you did a good job there.
Well, I'm not sure it was a matter of demolishing or not demolishing, and the fact of the matter is that I don't have all of the facts in front of me about the 83 bombing.
No.
I'm frankly, and you know, he called back to ask Kareth for my email address that he wanted to send me some information, which I look forward to getting. But the reality is that what has happened in the last 4 years or the last 5 years, what has happened is the most massive intelligence failure in the history of this country. It happened on the watch of George W. Bush, who's strutting around acting like he's a war president and a commander-in-chief. In fact, saying, you know, you got to remember, I'm a war president. And
yeah.
And that, you know, it's quite clear from reading Woodward's book, from reading the histories, from listening to what he's said, from looking at what he's done, that he believed that Karl Rove believed that getting into a war was the best way to put Republicans back into control of the Senate in 2002 and to take and hold the House and Senate and get Bush back into power in 2004. And Karl Rove was right.
Well, I hear you. But what I wanted to say was, you know, you mentioned honest conservatives like Goldwater and Eisenhower, and I don't think you're a real big fan of Ronald Reagan, but just let me tell you that when Ronald Reagan was in office and we had the Cold War and we had an enemy which had many intercontinental ballistic missiles aimed at us, Ronald Reagan did not opt for war. He actually formed a friendship with Mikhail Gorbachev, told him to tear down the Berlin Wall. It was torn down. They walked through the streets of Red Square. He called him his friend, and 2 years after he was out of office, Soviet communism and Eastern European communism was dead. Now, some people want to say, well, that's just because Gorbachev was more reasonable. Remember the Korean airliner incident?
Yeah, I do.
When Andropov was in power, and certainly not as reasonable a man as Gorbachev.
Yeah, Andropov, much like Putin, had been a former head of the KGB.
Exactly. And the point was, when that airliner was shot down, of course that was an atrocity. But there were right-wingers then that I guess wanted Reagan to start a nuclear war.
Oh, yeah.
And Reagan said, what do they want me to do, start a war and cost millions of lives? It wouldn't have been worth it.
Right.
That's the mark of a statesman, not a guy who wants to prove he's macho by starting a war by sending other people to die for him.
Yeah, well said. Well said, Rick. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I do appreciate it. It's the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. The Tom Hartman radio program, 10 minutes before the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Busted flat in Baton Rouge, waiting for a train, and I was feeling near as faded as my jeans. Bobby thumbed a diesel down just before it rained. It rode us all the way into New Orleans.
And welcome back, my friends. 4.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Just some good old music there. You know, it's sometimes I just want to... Oh, yeah.
Windshield wiper slapping time, I was holding Bobby's hand in mine. We sang every song that Javi knew. Freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose.
Yes, indeed.
Nothing. I mean, nothing, honey, if it ain't free.
Janis Joplin there, me and Bobby McGee. I'm sorry. I started in this business back in the late 60s as a DJ. It's still in my blood. I love radio and I love music. I want to get back to this timeline on what happened with the war in Iraq and how this came about and why the Downing Street memo is so important. And also to remind you that sometime in the next half hour or hour, the hearings will begin, and I will forgive you if you must go to your TV set and turn on C-SPAN, assuming you get C-SPAN 3, or to your computer. It will be on the web, although I have a feeling their servers are going to be just, you know, browned out. But to listen to the hearings, we are certainly going to be taping them here in the studio. And hopefully we'll have pieces of that for you tomorrow, and we'll have a conversation with Congressman Bernie Sanders about it tomorrow morning, and perhaps somebody else, some others in the afternoon. You know, we've had John Conyers on this program many times. I have a feeling he's going to be pretty busy over the next couple of days, but we'll see what we can do with that. But I want to get back to this timeline. We'll do so in depth in the next hour. But in the meantime, just in snapshot, the thing that really, 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 really makes me crazy right now is that Media Matters for America has done such a good job on this, MediaMatters.org, is that the newspapers across America are now already taking the right-wing spin on this, which is, hey, it's an old story. This happened back in 2002. They're taking that spin and saying, well, you know, I guess it's not really news. Now, imagine if the newspapers had said, hey, you know all the stuff they're talking about Bill and Monica? That happened a couple of years ago. That's an old story. Why should we report that now? Bill lied about Monica, but it happened a couple of years ago. Somehow, like, they didn't do that. And so why is it that newspapers, the New York Times, a couple of days ago, the New York Times ran a piece, basically, oh, this is old news. You know, this is not the Dead Sea Scrolls. I don't get it. The so-called liberal media? Yeah, right. The corporate media in America spinning it for the Bushies all over again. I'm Tom Hartman with you.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 7 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Truth and sanity on the radio. Rather than bimbo on insanity. Well, no, that's a cheap shot, isn't it? Anyhow, welcome back. So glad to be with you. Thank you for listening. TomHartman.com, our website, if you want to drop into our live chat room and hang out with some of the finest minds on the Internet. Folks listening in, participating on several continents, actually, at this moment, at this point in time. It's Thursday, and every Thursday, traditionally, we have a regular segment where we talk about the things that you thought that you knew, the things you didn't know that you didn't know, the things that you knew that you didn't know that you didn't know that you didn't know, the things that you thought, well, you know, that maybe even the things that you thought that you knew that you didn't know that were the things that you thought you needed to know, but you didn't know that you didn't know them, and therefore, how could you know that you needed to know them if you didn't know them? In other words, could it be that everything you know is wrong?
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync and think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Well, today we have a twofer. Two of them. The first is Shorty. This sometime last year, elevator workers at two hospitals drained hydraulic fluid into empty soaped containers and capped them without changing the labels. Not long afterward, medical staff complained, this in Raleigh, North Carolina, not long afterward, medical staff complained that some of their surgical tools felt slick. But it was not until January that nearly 4,000 patients learned that for 2 months their surgeons had unknowingly used instruments washed in hydraulic fluid instead of soap. Duke Medical Center assured patients that the mix-up created little chance of medical problems, which raises the question, should we start using hydraulic fluid instead of soap? I mean, or why use soap in the first place? That was a question that they were asking back before Louis Pasteur had his little eureka moment. Anyhow, that's the light one. The more serious of the two, and I, you know, interesting, I think, is this UPI story. It was published in the Washington Times, the only newspaper that George W. Bush reads. And I find this particularly strange. UPI is owned by Reverend Moon. The Washington Times is owned by Reverend Moon. Reverend Moon is a big supporter of Republicans. He's given hundreds of thousands of dollars to the Bush family. I mean, directly, in direct payments to the Bush family. And over the years, and has lost over $1 billion on the Washington Times to support Republican causes. Why is Reverend Moon running this story? I'm not sure, but there it is. It's in the Washington Times, UPI story. Let me share it with you very briefly. Here we go. A former Bush team member during his first administration is now voicing serious doubts about the collapse of the World Trade Center on 9/11. Former chief economist for the Department of Labor during President George W. Bush's first term, a fellow by the name of Morgan Reynolds, comments that the official story about the collapse of the World Trade Center is, quote, bogus, end quote, and that it is more likely that a controlled demolition destroyed the Twin Towers and adjacent building number 7. Reynolds, who also served as director of the Criminal Justice Center at the National Center for Policy Analysis in Dallas and is now professor emeritus at Texas A&M University, said, quote, if demolition destroyed three steel skyscrapers at the World Trade Center on 9/11, then the case for an inside job and a government attack on America would be compelling, end quote. Reynolds commented from his Texas A&M office, quote, it is hard to exaggerate the importance of a scientific debate over the cause of the collapse of the Twin Towers in Building 7. If the official wisdom on the collapses is wrong, as I believe it is, then policy based on such erroneous engineering analysis is not likely to be correct either. The government's collapse theory is highly vulnerable on its own terms. Only professional demolition appears to account for the full range of facts associated with the collapse of the three buildings. End of story. You heard it here first. Will it be picked up by the main? I mean, you know, when the Washington Times and the UPI run a story about, John Kerry accused of, desertion in Vietnam or something, or Hillary Clinton accused of kicking puppies, Of course, it gets picked up. Chris Matthews has three conservatives and maybe one liberal on to discuss it. It's all over the mainstream media. Will they pick up this story by John Daly in the Washington Times? Will they pick it up? Time will tell. Time will tell. And of course, I guess I'd be remiss if I didn't mention, although you probably already know, but worth mentioning, the Schiavo autopsy. Terry Schiavo, no brain. I mean, you know, half a brain. A half a brain is basically a brain stem. The part that keeps you breathing. But even the part that keeps you swallowing was not working. If you had put water in her mouth, she would have inhaled it and died. If you had put food in her mouth, she would have inhaled it and died. The part of her brain that controls swallowing, the part of her brain that controls vision, she was blind. That so much of her brain was gone, there was no possible thought process. And still, I guarantee you, the cons will be out there going on and on and on. These guys who, at one point in time, you know, true conservatives were saying, hey, we should leave private decisions up to families, and we should leave decisions about what is criminal and what is not criminal up to the states. Or how things get handled, such as end-of-life issues. Those should be states' rights issues. And now you've got this another example, the medical marijuana thing. Here in Oregon, we have medical marijuana, or we had it until last week, although, you know, the state is not backing down. I mean, they've stopped passing out the cards or authorizing doctors to pass out the cards, but 1,700 doctors in this state have prescribed medical marijuana. Prescribed is actually the wrong word, because you can't get a prescription filled for medical marijuana. They have recommended medical marijuana, which thus decriminalizes it for the user, to over 10,000 terminally ill patients and people with serious illnesses like multiple sclerosis and severe glaucoma, and for which it is known to be efficacious, that it's known to be effective. It's demonstrated that it works. People with AIDS, people with undergoing chemotherapy, people with severe pain. And yesterday there was a vote, I believe it was yesterday, might have been the day before, in the House of Representatives on whether or not the United States Congress should do what the Supreme Court asked them to do in their ruling. And did the Republicans have the courage to do what the conservative Republican Supreme Court asked them to do? The Supreme Court acknowledged that marijuana has medical value. They acknowledged that in their ruling. They also acknowledged that 10 states now have said that it is legal for doctors in those states to recommend medical marijuana and for people who use it to use it under the protection of the laws of the state. In other words, it's not criminal. It wouldn't be considered criminal activity in those states. But they pointed out that because there are federal laws against medical marijuana, against marijuana that preclude its use as a medicine, that until those federal laws are changed, the state laws don't override, they don't overrule the federal law. Now, you read the Tenth Amendment, you would think they do, but that was before the Civil War. Before the Civil War, we were in the era of strong states and weak federal government. After the Civil War, everything changed. And it changed in large part because of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which ended slavery. But what they also did was they handed to the federal government a lot of power, took a lot of power away from the states. And by and large, over the years, we've seen that that's probably been a good thing for the United States. It's how we ended desegregation. It's how we ended, a lot of good things have come out of it. And arguably some bad things have come out of it. And there are people, both conservatives and liberals, who will give you examples of both. But nonetheless, the Supreme Court said, you know, as long as there are federal laws in this post-Civil War era that say that, you know, marijuana is illegal, period, then if a state says you can use it for medical purposes, that's still technically illegal. So the Congress, this was in the Supreme Court ruling, the Supreme Court said Congress is going to have to change the federal laws. And so they ran it up the flagpole yesterday in the House of Representatives. Hey, let's change the laws so that states can have medical marijuana. It wasn't about decriminalizing pot. It wasn't about, hey, you're going to be able to buy it along with Marlboros at your corner 7-Eleven or your liquor store. It wasn't about any of that stuff. It was simply leave it up to the states.
If states want to line people up in front of a firing squad for using marijuana, they can do that. If, on the other hand, a state wants to say, hey, you've got MS or you're dying of AIDS or cancer and it eases your pain, you go at it. You can have some. It, regardless of what a state wants to say, leave it up to the states. This is what this law would have said. And the majority of Republicans, and virtually every Democrat in the House of Representatives voted in favor of it, and the majority of the Republicans voted no. It is the ongoing hysteria. And frankly, I have to say, I am very quickly coming to the conclusion that it's not just the ongoing hysteria. It's not the leftover reefer madness of the 30s where Harry Anslinger was basically saying, the way that marijuana criminalization was sold to white Americans, which was the power structure in America in the 1930s. The way that it was sold was that they were saying that if blacks were smoking pot, this was the drug of choice in black jazz clubs, particularly during Prohibition. Whites were drinking alcohol, blacks were smoking reefer. And they said, if black men smoke pot, they're going to want to rape white women. And that was, you know, that was the message of reefer madness. That was the message that was being put out subtly and not subtly. And when you look at who was behind that message, were the cotton and the paper industries. Because the Constitution of the United States was written on hemp, on marijuana, on paper made out of marijuana. And the Declaration of Independence was written on paper made out of marijuana. And you can still see them in the Capitol building in the United States, you know, in the U.S. Capitol, if they ever decide to let us in again. I mean, they're still there on display. And they're written on marijuana, on hemp. And the cotton industry was saying, and the paper and the pulp paper industry, they were saying, hey, this is significant competition. And I suspect that they're still saying that. And now you have people, you know, one of the most effective ways to generate oil from sunlight is hemp. So there's a strong constituency for not, this is for a form of cannabis that doesn't even get you high. It's still illegal. It doesn't even get you high. It's still illegal. You can grow it in Canada, but not in the United States. And why? The economic interests. And now we've got the private prison industry, a multi-billion-dollar industry, one of the fastest-growing industries in the United States, and they're lobbying strongly to keep the pot laws in place. Why? Well, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. So, anyhow. Keep an eye on it. We're going to get back to the timeline here on the war in Iraq. This critical stuff. And John Conyers' hearings right after this. 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Yeah, it's states' rights. Enough of states' rights. All these guys, Terry Schiavo, states' rights, pot, states' rights. I am a big believer in states' rights, but also in federal, in the rights of humans. In the rights of humans. It's not the buzzword, you know. It used to be states' rights was a buzzword for racism in the United States. So when I was a kid, you know, when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, that's what it meant. But, and I suppose in some quarters it still does. Okay, here, just very quickly, Greg Palast laid this thing out. February 2001, 1 month after Bush-Cheney inauguration, there's a secret meeting at the State Department. A woman by the name of Pam Quanrud organizes this thing to make plans to invade Iraq. And a oil industry advisor by the name of Falah Ajabouri is asked to interview people who might be replacements for Saddam. We're going to install our own dictator.
In fact, on BBC's television news night, Al Jabouri himself said, quote, "It is an invasion, but it will act like a coup. The original panel is to liberate Iraq from the Saddamists and from the regime," end of quote. March of 2001, the next month, this is all still pre-9/11, Vice President Dick Cheney meets with oil company executives and reviews oil map fields of Iraq. You can see these, by the way, on TomHartmann.com. We've got a couple of threads that link to them on the message board. Also, you can see them over at the group that initially sued Dick Cheney's website. Oh my! It'll come to me in a minute. Anyway, they're all over the web. The folks who initiated the lawsuit. And so anyhow, these plans laid out, they had a map of over 100 different oil fields in Iraq. Over 100 different oil fields in Iraq. And showing, you know, here's the different oil fields, and they had a list of potential suitors. In fact, it was called potential suitors for Iraq. Listing... Jim Bios, when Tom's on, I'm so unprotected. Thank you very much. Trying to read the message board at the same time. Anyhow, they had a list of potential suitors for Iraq, and they were listing what companies in what countries may be interested in buying Iraq's oil. Now, this was in 2001, in March of 2001. This was the infamous meeting that Dick Cheney had with Ken Lay and other oil industry executives to plan the energy policy of the United States. Dick Cheney had been put in charge of two task forces, the counterterrorism task force to look for Osama bin Laden. That task force never met until September of 2001. And the energy policy task force, which met regularly with oil industry executives, excluded anyone. JudicialWatch.org, by the way, is the name of the organization. The energy task force, which met regularly with oil industry executives and excluded anybody from the renewable industries at all. Okay, very simple, very straightforward. And this is Judicial Watch sued them, and you know the whole thing has been laid out. It's right there. In October and November of 2001. Now this is after 9/11. An easy military victory in Afghanistan, writes Greg Pallast, emboldens then Deputy Secretary Paul Wolfowitz to convince the administration to junk the State Department's coup plan. They were going to have this what looked like a coup of Saddam, in favor of a full-scale invasion and occupation to remake the economy of Iraq. What they wanted to do is they wanted to create a libertarian state, an Ayn Rand state, an ideal conservative state, open all the borders to multinational corporations, eliminate all laws that prevented corporations from taking all of their profits out of the country so that multinationals could strip mine the country, make labor unions illegal, and they've done that now. These are all parts of the new Iraqi constitution that we've written, and show what a utopian state could be like. And because they really expected, I think these guys really believed that once they did this, do away with Social Security, do away with all welfare programs, and tell people, hey, pull yourself up by your bootstraps right now. And they thought that this was going to create a paradise, because that's what they're trying to do here in the United States. And I think they have the best of intentions. The problem is they're just wrong. And you're seeing the results of it in Iraq right now, 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, well, we're going to make it through. I'm telling you, America is waking up. We are coming back around. America is waking up to what's going on with this administration. A good symptom of that is what's going on right now, right this minute, as we speak in Washington, D.C., as John Conyers is convening a hearing on the Downing Street memo and the lies that the Bush administration told to get us into this war. Greg Gorman, in fact, with the Talk Radio News Service, is with us, reporting from Washington, D.C. Hey, Greg, what's going on there? Oh, hang on just a second, Greg. Got to push the button. There you go. Now you're live.
Hey, Tom, you're so optimistic about what's happening in the country.
I have spent a lot of my life studying the history of this country, and what you see is that the pendulum just swings back and forth and back and forth, and it never sticks on one side. Never, 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 ever. And it's swinging back.
And what's funny is that what I called in a little while ago, and I heard a little bit of your show, and I know you were talking about Iraq, and I think what's interesting is I was at the White House gaggle and the White House briefing today. I've just gotten back to our studio, and the White House is pressing hard on winning the war on terror, and they are doing everything they can to make sure that we all think that what's going on in Iraq is central to winning the war on terror. And the president has this new, I guess it's a new approach. Scott McClellan touched on it twice. It's called, or what he's saying is, the president is trying to sharpen his focus over the next few weeks in all his public appearances, all his radio appearances. One is winning the war on terror, and two is economic security. And he touched on that. That's pretty much what the entire briefing was about.
And economic security means?
Well, according to the White House, it means keeping gas low, continue to build jobs, continue to build home ownership. Of course, then someone asked, well, I thought the president said that he can't do anything about lowering gas prices.
Right.
Which, of course.
And it sounds like they're not talking about Social Security anymore.
Well, you know, they are, but they've realized that. I mean, it's obviously not a home run. The president wanted it to be.
Yeah, it's a classic open mouth, insert foot here. Well,
that's right. And so, you know, Social Security, they're still working with Congress, and it's a high priority. Now, according to what the White House says, they have some Democrats who are breaking with the Democratic leadership who are finally, according to them, finally coming out with some ideas. You know, we've been asking for ideas. We're open to all that you've heard. They're finally coming forward with some ideas. And Scott McClellan did say the president will be speaking about that as well. But like I said, the sharpening focus thing, he's on it.
Yeah.
One, winning the war on terror. Two, economic security. They're really trying to make sure that we know that the only way to break this, you know, break terrorism and send a message is to win the war in Iraq.
So, number one, what they're saying is they're not going to talk about all the other scandals that involve the administration or Bush, in the Bush-Cheney. They're not going to talk about, you know, lying us into the war. They're not going to talk about the Cheney memos and the Cheney meetings that the Supreme Court allowed him to keep secret until after the elections. They're not going to talk about Guantanamo. They're not going to talk, in other words, they're not going to talk
Absolutely
about
not.
The stuff they don't want to talk about, period.
They're
going to
talk
it.
About rhetoric, and you're going to hear, I actually wrote this down. All my things are quotes because I've heard them 100 times. The stakes are high in Iraq. The terrorists know the stakes are high. A free Iraq will send a powerful message. I mean, it's complete rhetoric. We've all heard it before. You may not, maybe you've heard already, on June 24th, the president is going to have the Iraqi prime minister at the White House.
Yeah.
And then on June 28th, he's going to have a big rallying speech. We don't have the details yet. On the one-year anniversary of handing the sovereignty over to the Iraqi people. So this administration is doing its best to keep the focus on Iraq.
Just like we did with Diem in Vietnam. I mean, it's you're probably not old enough to remember that.
Well, I am. And, you know, it's interesting that all that Vietnam talk kind of died out a few months ago. Maybe you're keeping it going. But it's funny you said that. For the first time today, I heard, is this going to be another Vietnam? And I hadn't heard that in a few months around the White House.
Yeah, because we handed sovereignty over to South Vietnam.
And then what happened?
Yeah, and you know, we're defending a sovereign nation. Oh, you know, well, we'll support a coup. And, you know, this guy isn't working for us. We'll get another guy in there. I mean, I've seen this movie before, Greg.
Well, that's exactly what I'm hearing around the White House briefing. There are reporters who have been covering the White House for 40, 30, 20, 10 years, and of course, you know, I'm new, but right, everyone is starting to really realize this story's been played out before, we're seeing it before. You know, I think the president I saw today, 43%, he's doing whatever he can, and I'm not sure it's going to work.
Yeah, Frank Luntz has been doing his focus grouping and has figured out what words to use and what words not to use, and the obstructionist, I'm on the right, on the mailing list for all the right-wing, you know, talk show hosts, and I get the talking points every day.
Oh, good.
And the talking points for the
what
last 2 days, the last 2 days in a row, the talking points have been number one about use of the word obstructionist. You're supposed to use the word obstructionist as often as you can. We're going to characterize the Democrats as obstructionists.
That's right. That's right.
So you're going to hear that word a lot.
Especially the Democratic leadership, which they love to say. The Democratic leadership. The Democratic leadership.
That's correct. And the reason why they say the Democratic leadership is because the average people in middle America may like their Democratic congressman. And in fact, most Democratic members of Congress and the Senate are you know, relatively safe. They're going to get reelected. And so if they simply beat up Democrats, people go, well, wait a minute, I got a good Democrat. But if they beat up the Democratic leadership, that's basically only, you know, the only people that they offend are the people of Nevada, you know, Harry Reid's hometown. And, you know,
that's what I was about to say. They love going after Senator Reid.
Yeah, and Nancy Pelosi in California.
And
you know, and they're beating up Democrats in those places anyway. And they lied to the Nevadans about the nuclear waste. And so, you know, it's just so they're fine tuning this and they're getting the word out. Interesting. Okay. And Conyers is holding his hearings right now.
He's there now. We have a reporter in there. He's there now. He's going to be getting some audio for us that we'll put up later. This is a very interesting hearing, of course. There was a lot of controversy about where it was going to be held. This Downing Street memo, a couple of other people today have asked me if I thought it was actually going to be a story. At first, I thought it wasn't. I thought, you know, they'll find a way to gloss over it. Now, Conyers has written this letter. 88 other members of Congress have signed it. A question was asked in the briefing, why is the White House glossing over this? Why will they not at least respond? And at first Scott said, well, you know, look, it's not that, you know, we've talked about this before. And the reporter said, Scott, 88 other people signed this letter. It's not just, you know, it's not Representative Conyers. It's not a one-man thing. 88 people, 88
members of Congress
have signed this letter. Why will the White House not?
And now it's over 100, by the way.
Okay, now it's over 100, right. Well, you know, and all McClellan said was, we've discussed this before. And
yeah, now can you imagine,
down.
I mean, this is basically, this is basically the position that the New York Times took in an article 2 days ago in which they said that this is not the Dead Sea Scrolls, this is an old story, you know, blah-de-blah-de-blah. Can you imagine if the Clinton administration had tried to say, oh, Monica Lewinsky, you know, that happened a couple of years ago. Because it did. It did. It happened
it did.
A couple of
that's
years
right.
before.
It came out,
you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And that's been discussed before, and that's been discussed in the newspaper. This is old news. And, oh, Bill Clinton lied about it. Yeah, but, you know, he lied about something that happened years ago. That you know, go away. And would they do it? Would they go away?
No, people wouldn't stand for that, especially with a Republican House and a Republican-controlled Senate. They'd be on it faster than...
And they were.
As we say in Texas, white on rice.
Yeah, yeah. And they were. And they were.
And they were, and they did, and we all know what happened. So, right, and so now, so my point was, I think I've changed my mind. I do believe the Downing Street memo, thanks to Representative Conyers, thanks to these hearings today, Conyers will actually, you know, we'll see what happens, we'll see what comes out of it, but I don't think this is going anywhere.
Yeah, okay. You don't think what's going to go anywhere?
I don't think the story is going to go away. I think it's going to stick
around.
Oh, in other
words, okay, good. Yeah, it's not going away.
Exactly.
Good. Let's hope it goes somewhere. Let's hope it goes right to the top. Let's hope it, you know, nails the folks that are responsible for lying us into this war, in my opinion, for partisan purposes. I am convinced that the main reason why Bush did this the way he did and when he did was to take the Senate back in 2002 and to hold on to the White House in 2004. And, you know, to be a war president, and that 1,700 Americans have now died for George Bush's political ambitions. And I think, you know, and the same thing when he was governor of Texas and he executed more people than any governor in any state in the history of the United States. And we've had death penalty for a long, long time.
That's right.
And he did it because he thought it would make him politically popular. And it did.
He's
perfectly willing to kill people for political popularity, whether they're guilty or not. Apparently, he never took more than 10 minutes to evaluate any of those death penalty sentences. And we know now that probably at least 10% of them were innocent people. So, but anyhow, that's a whole other rant. Greg Gorman with the Talk Radio News Service. Thanks so much for being with us, Greg.
Always good to be with you, Tom.
Always good to talk to you. I appreciate it. Thank you so much. Talk Radio News Service, Greg Gorman. Alice in Humboldt County on the line. Hey, Alice, how's life there in Humboldt County in KGOE?
Well, I guess you read about in the paper we had a big earthquake and they worried about a tsunami.
Hey, I live on the water. In a houseboat, more or less, you know, floating house in Portland, Oregon. And our daughter came and woke us up. We go to bed early because I get up at 2:30 in the morning to 3 o'clock in the morning to do this morning show on KG or on the radio station here in Portland, KPOJ. And our daughter came and woke us up, and there's a tsunami alert, and we're like on the river, right? And is it going to come up the river? And we were all a little nervous there for a few minutes, but yeah, it was a 2-inch tall tsunami, so I guess we all made it through, Alice.
Yeah, well, I watched I watched the day that it happened. I happened to go to on the highway, and it was, you can't believe, there was not a bit of noise, not any wind, nothing. And I told my son, I said, remember this. This is not the way it usually is. It's usually blowing and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when it hit.
Hmm. Interesting.
So I think it's good to watch, you know.
Yeah.
Well, what I called about was Bush's White House team does so much evil. They said they would need their new Pearl Harbor, and they brought one down on us.
Now, well, Alice, you're 91 years old. You've been observing the political scene since Franklin Roosevelt and before.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, back when Pearl Harbor happened, there were folks who said that FDR engineered that. What did you think about that?
Well, I heard that. In fact, my husband had talked to someone that had worked with the president there, and so I always thought there might have been something, but there was a reason why it was done.
Yeah, yeah.
There always is a reason.
Yeah, you know? And so, but you think that the Bush, you think it was through his failure that 9/11 happened, or do you think that he let it happen intentionally?
Oh,
or,
of course.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely.
It's a tragic thing to hear hear that opinion. It really
I know
is.
It. I know it.
Alice, thank you so much.
Okay.
Always good to hear from you. I appreciate it. I got to tell you, a friend of mine interviewed, in fact, he and I are writing a book together, which will be out next year, interviewed, I shouldn't name the guy right now because, in fact, I probably shouldn't even tell the story. I'm not going to. This had to do with Roosevelt and Pearl Harbor. But let me tell you, the bottom line is, you know, I have some pretty solid evidence that Roosevelt didn't know that Pearl Harbor was going to happen. And I'll just leave it at that. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone. Now, I want to just very quickly finish up this timeline, and then we'll go back to the phone lines. An easy military victory. October, November 2001, Wolfowitz says, hey, let's create this state. 2002, Grover Norquist and other corporate lobbyists, now they're sensing, hey, there's money, right? There's money to be made here. They meet secretly with defense, state, and treasury officials to ensure the invasion plans for Iraq include plans for protecting property rights. The result was a pre-invasion scheme to sell off Iraq's oil fields, its banks, its electric systems, and even change the country's copyright laws to the benefits of the multinational corporations and their lobbyists, the clients of these lobbyists, like Grover Norquist. The occupation chief, Paul Bremer, would later order these giveaways into Iraqi law, and did. They rewrote the Iraqi constitution to do this. Fall of 2002, Philip Carroll, the former CEO of Shell Oil USA, brought in by the Pentagon to plan the management of Iraq's oil fields. Now, keep in mind, this is all still, I mean, this is, we're still way back here. We're still way back here where George Bush is saying that this is, that you know, war?
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
This is when Bush is still saying this kind of stuff. And Philip Carroll, fall of 2002, former CEO of Shell Oil USA, brought in specifically, works with Wolfowitz and Feith. There are plans, says Carroll, maybe even too many plans, but none disclosed to the public. This from Greg Pallas. January 2003. Robert E. Bell, former CIA oil analyst, is sent, BBC learns, to London to meet with Fawad Chalabi to plan terms for taking over Iraq's oil. March of 2003, White House spokesman Ari Fleischer calls Operation Iraqi Liberation, the acronym OIL, begins. Once it gets out in the press that the Operation Iraqi Liberation stands, the acronym is OIL, they change it to Operation Iraqi Freedom. Every time you hear Operation Iraqi Freedom, remember it was originally Operation Iraqi Liberation, OIL. Now it's OIF. March of 2003, the Defense Department is told in confidence by U.S. Energy Information Administrator Guy Caruso that Iraq's oil fields are incapable of a massive increase in output. Despite this intelligence, Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz testifies to Congress that the invasion is going to be a free ride. He swears under oath, there's a lot of money to pay for this. It doesn't have to be U.S. taxpayer money. We're dealing with a country that can really finance its own reconstruction relatively soon.
It was a deliberate fabrication promoted by the administration, an insider told the BBC, as part of the sales pitch for war. May of 2003, General Jay Garner, appointed by Bush as viceroy over Iraq, he calls for elections. Remember, Jay Garner comes in, says, okay, we've taken over the country, let's have elections. He's fired by Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld. The general revealed in an interview for BBC that he resisted White House plans to sell off Iraq's oil and national assets. That's one fight you don't want to take on, Garner told Greg Palast, but apparently the White House wanted the fight. The general also disclosed that these invade-and-grab plans were developed long before the U.S. assertion that Saddam still had weapons of mass destruction. He said, this is the general, General Jay Garner. He says, all I can tell you is the plans are pretty elaborate. They didn't start them in 2002. They were started in 2001. November, December 2003, secrecy and misinformation continues even after the invasion. On it goes. John Conyers trying to get to the bottom of it, 10 minutes before the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
You and me, welcome back. 4.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a quick note here. This is a little story in the an AP story in the Washington, in the Wall Street Journal today. Dateline Hanoi, Vietnam. Vietnam has recorded 6 new cases of bird flu in the past week, state-controlled media and officials said. The institute, this is the National Institute for Hygiene and Epidemiology of Vietnam, is researching whether the virus has evolved to allow for faster transfer. Bird flu has killed 38 people in Vietnam, 12 in Thailand, and 4 in Cambodia since it ravaged poultry farms in Asia in late 2003. Now, I shared with you a month and a half or so ago an article in the Wall Street Journal about Tamiflu, the only compound, a substance that can help the immune system and fight off flu that somebody has already acquired. It's a drug. It's in the marketplace. You have to have a prescription for it. And how the Wall Street Journal basically ran an article saying rich people are stocking up on Tamiflu and only the wealthy in the United States will probably survive a major flu epidemic because the government is not helping subsidize or encourage the manufacturer of Tamiflu to come up with enough stores to deal with a pandemic. After all, if they did that, they would have to roll back the tax breaks on millionaires and billionaires. And so, you know, who's George Bush looking out for? And basically said, hey, if you've got the income and you've got a wealthy doctor who is willing to write a prescription for it, and, you know, go for it, go get yourself some Tamiflu and get ready because the bird flu is coming. So yeah, now you know. Logan in New York on the line. Hey, Logan, we've got about a half a minute left. What's up?
I just wanted to know why people don't draw more the relationships between the middle class being a strong entity and national security.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the flu is national security. It's like, you know, the Bushies, it's like if it has to do with the middle class, if it has to do with average Americans, they're just not interested, period. They'd rather, you know, they've got to have their tax cuts for billionaires and they got to have their $300 billion war in Iraq and all the oil that goes with it.
Yeah, and that corruption creates a weaker country.
That's right. That's right. Not just a weaker country, a more vulnerable country, unfortunately, a despised country. And that's not the America that I was raised in. That's not the America that I want my children to be living in. I want us
The
moral leader. Thank you, Logan. I want us to be the moral leader of the world again. And, you know, we once were. We were for a long, long time the moral leader of the world. It's time for us to recover that high ground because that's the ultimate weapon against terror. If you want to have a so-called war on terrorism, be a moral example for the world. You can't force things on people that they don't want. But if you've got something good, you don't have to force it on them. All you have to do is show an example of it, and they will steal it. They will go for it. They will take it. We did that before. We did that for years. Over 100 nations followed our example. We need to do it again rather than holding people without even the access to a court. It's nuts. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.